Comparellon? How would you go with that? I wrote it out. I just never tried to pronounce it.
Comparellon.
Is it
Comparellon.
Comparellon. C-O-M-P-O-R-E-L-L-O-N.
I have it spelled right.
Comparellon. Comparellon.
Comparellon. Comparellon. Okay.
Comparellon.
Okay. Let's try this again.
Elon like melon.
Melange.
And welcome back to season 4, episode 6 of the Such Nerds podcast. I'm your host for tonight, Peter, and we're going to be covering the Agent chapter this week because this one is so dense. Why don't you introduce yourselves to the audience who don't already know who you are, gentlemen?
Jason from Florida.
Dan from Los Angeles, North America.
So why don't you kick off the summary for this week, Dan, because I think we got a lot to talk about.
So quick summary this week, Trevis catches up with his old ex-friend Compor on Seychelles in Seychelles sector. Compor explains his prior actions and warns Trevis that Earth is a dead end, directing him to Comparellon instead. After he and Compor exchange pleasantries, Trevis joins Pellerot for a meal to discuss the encounter, with Trevis insisting they remain on Seychelles in defiance of Compor's suggestion. Meanwhile, Compor's true nature is revealed as he discusses next steps with Gendebal.
Seashells on the Seychelles by the seashore.
Seychelles seashore.
From her she shed.
Yeah. It's a tough one. Pronunciation.
Yes, this one is dense.
Yeah, there's lots
of back and forth, lots of mind games.
And then a giant reveal in the middle of the chapter to sort of
right.
Like, as you think you're getting to the end, it's like bam!
Boom.
And then a little personal touch at the end is it's got everything. I laughed. I cried.
Did you really cry, Dan?
I cried while laughing.
It's not necessarily about the story, but yeah. Just watching somebody not recycle, throw garbage on the trash and thing. It was like a.
That was right before you started slow clapping.
We left off sort of last week. You know, they had at the end of the chapter, the two of them lock eyes. They're like their arch nemesis from across the galaxy.
Right.
And
they compare the size of each other's Schwartzes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they realize that your Schwartz is as big as mine.
As big as mine. I see your torso. Well, judging by the torso on, that's Gendebal, I guess. He probably outweighs them both.
No, that wasn't Gendebal. That was Compor.
That was Compor? Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right, Peter?
Sorry.
Peter, you remember, you got to remember. The smooth and muscular torso that the silky sheets just slipped right off of when he moved out of the bed, right? You didn't latch on to that?
I figured you'd be all over that.
What? You missed Compor's Hobermallow moment?
I missed that.
I don't know. They didn't describe whether he was down to the skin or not, but
was down to the skin
in certain parts.
I mean, when I read this book, I just assume nobody's wearing any clothes ever. So,
I'm sorry, Dan. I stand corrected.
It
is Gendebal.
Look at you coming in hot and completely wrong.
He does have his lean runner's physique from all that cross country.
He says, and there's nothing about him talking about how he's like super rocked or something, but. I thought he woke him up with sort of the mind.
Compor wakes Gendebal up by
mind signal.
But what he does is he just affected the arousal center directly. And woke Gendebal up
while he was podcast, guys.
In the buff, in his silky sheets of the brain, Peter. So it's Gendebal, and he gets roused by Compor. In the night, because Compor tickles his arousal center, and then
remotely,
from a distance,
in the foundation way,
from a distance, when Jendabal sits up, the silky sheets slip off of his smooth and muscular torso.
We definitely thought this was the most important part of the chapter. All the points talking about how much things are happening and how much it's talking about. And oh, by the way, seven solid minutes about torso, bed sheets, arousal methods.
Let's maybe kind of back up a little. So, Dan, thank you very much for that fantastic summary.
Mostly because correct summary.
It is a burden I'm sure that you do not carry lightly. You take it very seriously and always deliver every week with a nice, concise summary of what's going on here. And then it's up to us.
It's clear, too. Let's not.
Absolutely. Crystal clear. For the responsible reader who cares about their time, they can just listen to Dan's summary,
just turn it
shut off.
Off
the rest of the podcast, and listen to the next episode.
I hope
they can be an expert on meta-summarizing the summaries of Asimov to their friends.
Yeah. Otherwise, people might get the wrong idea about my organization and what I'm trying to do.
Right.
So I'm really hoping that they cut out after the summary.
But because of my personal philosophy that, you know, like you have to allow a little bit of waste and a little bit of chaos to find those magical gems that, you know, you can't organize yourself into discovering. Mm-hmm. We just got to go and deconstruct and just go down some bunny trails and explore some ideas. And we'll hit a lot of dead ends, a couple brick walls. But maybe there'll be a few moments worth not scrapping on the cutting room floor by the time we get to the end of our recording.
That's the only way. It's the only way that you're able to capture lightning in a bottle is to jump out into space a little bit.
Stand out in the storm. Hold it up to the sky.
You gotta have a storm for there to be lightning, baby.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's get into it.
So the title of this chapter, we're only talking about one chapter, and it is called Agent. You know, I didn't realize it because, of course, I jump right past the title and I start reading the words. It was like, as I was getting to the end of the chapter, I'm like, yeah, that's what this is about. And it was obvious, obviously, with the reveal.
Now, was that an abbreviation of like age not, or is it a gent like old men? Or is it?
No.
Am I missing the point entirely?
Someone is an agent of the Foundation.
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, I missed that. Was that in the summary?
I did not summarize it. I pointed out that he revealed his true nature, which as a point is a cliffhanger, but his true nature, as we'll touch on later, is he's a second foundationer with all that it entails. But not a second foundationer, a lower level kind of second foundation underling.
Yeah. He's like a like a scout.
They call him an observer, which I imagine implies, you know,
he's like
observation.
Almost like a recruiter or like a scout.
First of all, I think it's okay. I think we should delve into Compor a bit. I think there's a lot to unpack there with his whole relationship with the Second Foundation and the First Foundation and what they go into, even about Trevise and trying to recruit him. Yeah, it's like I get the idea that there is like this hive kind of mentality, but at the same time, there's this crabs in a bucket thing going on. That's an analogy that you say, Peter, that I more and more with the Second Foundation, I see that the guys are like, they isolate themselves inside this confined, limited population of special people. And then they're all like clawing at each other's backs to get ahead and try to achieve a seat at the table and be the speaker or be a speaker, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other part of that I find interesting is that they only recruit on Trantor. They limit their pool to like one location. And there's a lot of hand wringing about Trevise and that we should have, you know, bent the rules so we could get better people aside from just the one where have it.
Yeah.
That's the only place that they won't recruit, right, is on,
yeah,
on Terminus.
On Terminus, right?
Right.
So they won't recruit on Foundation proper, right? But they'll recruit everywhere else. But they, you know, the OG Trevise has a touch of the prescience or the instinct, right?
Right.
And and then
got the worm sign.
That's why they've been, I guess that was what piqued Munley's interest in him, was that he kind of demonstrated this kind of supernatural ability that would have gotten you recruited into the second foundation if you weren't
blackballed.
He wasn't blackballed, if he wasn't, you know, on the red scare list or whatever.
So Compor, the reason Compor knows this is because he was recruited at a young enough age, right, that he could be manipulated. But at the same time, he was not trained sufficiently to influence people's minds, only to read them, only to observe and communicate back with Foundation proper, or a second Foundation proper, you know, higher level second Foundationers, right? Speakers and whatnot.
I also got the impression that our boy Mun Li didn't have the aptitude to become like a higher level or a deeper, I don't know how to describe it, higher up in the ranks, but deeper into the conspiracy of the second Foundation.
A more senior executive.
Right. Because when he meets
managerial position of the Foundation, tableman, I guess.
Because when he meets Gendebal, right, he's like, oh, I can't even touch this guy. He's so much.
Well, Gendebal's, they said he's like 4 years younger than him. But he's been spoken as sort of like a savant in terms of like his table. Yeah, he's the youngest tableman, and he is looking to be the youngest first speaker. He's like a somewhat of a anomaly in the second Foundation table. So, I mean, if you're not up to the level of Gendebal, it's probably like, you know, somebody who's in line to be going to be first speaker from our last section. It's like, you know, no shame in being the fifth best Rubik's Cube doer in the world. Still better than most people.
I mean, how much idiot in the idiot savant do you think we're going to see out of Gendebal in the future?
But I don't know. Yeah, we'll have to see. But I got the impression that you're right, Dan. Like, that's a good way to put it. There's almost like two worlds that he lives in, because in the second Foundation world, he's like squashed down to this like lower, you know, peon like level. Some, but at the same time
level,
the people even at that level are still able to achieve like amazing success in the regular, you know, universe that they actually have to exist in, and like their daytime persona, if you will, because of their skills, they can climb right to the top and become a councilman of the first Foundation, even, you know.
Right. And that seems like a really important detail too, that's kind of how they are in the know about all these things that are going on, right? Didn't we have a second Foundationer in during the initial conspiracy ring when they were trying to make the mind wave blocking devices in the third Foundation book?
Anton, or what was his name? Antov?
Yeah.
What so was it's his like name? Antonov? No, that's the airplane.
Antor.
Anthor, Peleus. Thank you, Dan.
Peleus is too close to what it would sound like if you climbed into a 14-year-old girl's bedroom at night for me to be comfortable. And she just let him in. I mean,
I know.
It's a new Aizuma. It's not the old Aizuma.
Right. So
in many ways.
Nuclear, possibly bad, question mark?
Yeah.
Before we get there, I think there's another piece of what he touches into Trevise's mind enough to recognize that, like, he's special in a special way. Like, he's a special, special mind. It's not just like he's a highly capable mind. He also has this kind of seeming gaps in his power, mental powers, and starting to reinforce the suspicion that we, I think, have stated in previous episodes that one of the two guys on the ship together has got to be an agent of this, you know, of the other Foundation, right? And now we've ruled out the likelihood that Trevise is supporting the second Foundation. So it just amplifies his potential for being a potential third Foundationer. And I think that kind of same amplification occurred for me as I was reading through the section about Gendebal and his affection for Novi. Is it Sura Novi? I had the same feeling with him, like this, you know, this mind is so symmetrical and perfect and like so unique in this regard, and like, not, he's not at all suspicious that he's like strangely, he's actually slightly suspicious that he's strangely influenced by her, you know, comforting him. Yeah, I mean, Trevise and Novi have both kind of in my perspective, amplified their suspiciousness of being agents of the Third Foundation or the Anti-Mutants or whatever you want to call them.
I've also got a thing in for Pellerot. Seems a little bit, he's got that sort of like aloof, clueless guy vibe that's, you're kind of like, but he still knows a heck of a lot about certain things, you know. It's always the ones you don't expect, but clearly as the, you know, the chips started falling with Compor being the Second Foundationer, it's a question of how many more chews will fall with regards to who aligns where. But I guess, you know, there's a couple different teams that they could be on. You never know who's on which team.
I don't know. I question everything that's going on with our boy Mun Lee at this point. Like the whole story that he's got. Oh, I've got a pregnant wife at home. Like, is that true? Do you? Really?
Yeah, after the meeting where Compor sort of falls on his sword a little bit and tries to apologize for his behavior at the with the mayor and everything else, and Therese is just not having it at all. And then, you know, Compor sort of says what is a true statement or true information, knowing that Trevise is going to not listen to him, to direct him somewhere, knowing that he'll do the opposite and stay.
It's like, I bet you can't clean up.
I bet
your
you
room.
It's like he Bugs Bunny Elmer Fudds him a little bit. And right. And then they go to the meal, and like, it's like a throwback because Trevise is like full on like foundation paranoia, where he's like, oh, well, he would say that because he means this, and then of course he's saying that he doesn't want me to do this, you know. It's like, he would, that's just what he would say. Pellerat's like, well, maybe he just said it because that's what he wants you to do. He's like, well, that's ridiculous, there's no way he would do that, he's definitely up to no good. And it's kind of like he's like in a full paranoia, just like working himself up into a ladder.
Pellerat's, why would, like, I want to go to the serious, like,
yeah, what kind of response? It's ridiculous. He wants me to leave, so I'm gonna stay home. And it's like, you kind of want you to stay home, so he uses the reverse psychology, and it seems to work because he's like, we're not going anywhere.
That's exactly what you want me to think.
That's what you'd want me to think, you thought I was thinking. And so it seems to work because he's like, I ain't going nowhere. And meanwhile, he's calling in the reinforcements.
Trevise immediately stayed in, didn't go to the party, and cleaned his room.
Yeah.
Ate all his peas.
It's exactly. I want to go on the yard work simulator. Stays home and he does what he's supposed to do, except in a different manner. But no, I mean, he's just kind of like, we're going to go to a restaurant. They go to a restaurant, and then he's like, we're just going to go back to
intuition now, brother.
Yeah, exactly. Then we're going to go to the museums and go, you know, around Seychelles sector, Seychelles prefecture. And, you know,
right next to the Seychelles.
Yeah. Center. Just tool around there and see what they can find out. And that's exactly what Compor is hoping that he does. So it ends up that, and then you're kind of like, oh, that's interesting. And then it's like, bam, Second Foundation.
Right.
And Compor's fully on. And then it's like, oh, and the aforementioned intimate mind wake up circumstance occurs.
And so, you know, that going back to his inability to influence minds, but just to observe them. He actually kind of exerts, to your point, Dan, that he exerts some kind of clever behavior by telling truths in such a way that he influences the decision-making of Trevise. And there's a great quote when he's explaining this to Jindabal in their, which we could probably talk about next, their little mind portal moment. And Jindabal quotes Pareem Palver. Remember him, Peter? Pareem Palver?
Who? Yeah, I remember Pareem Palver.
Oh, now you do? Okay.
The thick daddy with coveralls? Yeah, I remember that dude.
It says, Palver once said, the closer the truth, the better the lie. And the truth itself, when it can be used, is the best lie. That was pretty much my general skepticism of all politicians. and makes me like just again amplifies my skepticism of the value or the benefit of the second foundation to the future of humanity.
I mean, when they laid their plans like nakedly out on like, I don't know, the first or second chapter where they're like, look, we got to get it great. So then we can just swoop in and take it over. Like, oh, okay. So these guys aren't like as altruistic as we thought that they were.
Yeah.
Or they presented themselves like in the first and second and third books.
Mm-hmm. Well,
second and third, really. So
Kompor is just an observer. He's not a full second foundationer. So when things go awry because the second foundation, you'd be like, don't blame me. I voted for Kodos. totally different. Not my job. Yeah. I voted for the other guy, even if he was.
I voted still, for the other.
The other second foundation mind controlling entity that was
mutant.
Totally. No, it's just speaker table speakers from me. Totally different. It's going back to the point from before where it's like, is this the nature of the second foundation is who they are, or is it just that this iteration of the second foundation is sort of like completely inept and bumbling, and they've gotten this far? Is that by accident, or is it because there was, you know, a Teddy Roosevelt or something that was great, and then we threw out Calvin Coolidge last week?
Yeah. Well, they mentioned an Inber moment. They mention the three like legacies, and the one in the middle was kind of like a doofus and didn't belong at the table, but he got in by being a legacy. Like,
oh, if it's second foundation people or tablemen.
Well, they said the children of the speakers never made it to the table, except for this one where there was like three in a row, but the one in the middle really shouldn't have been there or something.
Nah. Or is it also that once you were on the table, you were like, you don't want this for my children. I don't, you guys don't want any part of this type of job. Why don't you go do something else, literally anything else? Once you see how the sausage gets made.
Yeah. And they also talked about like the filtration of information and like their example of not paying attention to everything in the communications. I know we haven't gotten into that yet, but they talk about how, you know, when the mules first notice, there's this fair, you know, this folk tale that the first observer who noticed the mule sent his message over, and the person at the table like misread it because they didn't hear the part about it being just his proper name. They thought it was an actual animal, the mule, and they totally disregarded the message, and it never made it up to the table. And it's like it was like Inber's day, and you know, cutting stuff out, and he's not getting the message on the first foundation side of the world. Yeah,
of the galaxy. It becomes this sort of second foundation slam. Genderball, horse-like creature. He's like, oh, crushed.
Yeah,
burn, sick burn,
sick burn. Exactly.
I like that. Preem Palver like had like a great expansion of second foundation powers that he like enacted. He's like, all right, we're going to need a CIA, an NSA, an FBI, and tobacco, alcohol, and firearms to kind of help us regulate. Yeah, Department of Homeland Security, help us regulate, you know, these guys a little bit better so we don't have another second foundation being revealed scenario, because that was really what kicked everything off.
Yeah, I mean, but when I think about it, back a little bit, you know, they kept throwing at the various ends of the chapters when they were wrapping it up. It was just like when they were talking to Trevirs and Pelerath, they were all like, oh, he almost noticed that somebody was somewhere out behind him. Did he notice, or was the out portions of his mind where it was there something trailing him or not? Like, I remember two different times where they sort of alluded to sort of somebody in the back sort of circumstances. And it's like, is it, now that you know what he is, it's like, well, maybe that was sort of a throw into what it actually was.
Word.
Well, what I think is one of the most interesting reveals is that, you know, the story of the folktale involving Earth. And the fact that Earth, you know, Mun Li has this tale that Earth belonged in the Sirius sector, something that, you know, apparently is an actual story that circulates.
It's a serious story, Peter.
It's a serious story about...
And it's straight out of Kompor.
Surely he can't be serious. All right, I'll
stop. Don't call me Shirley.
So Dr. Dran Mun Li, or straight out of Kompor. they have this tale that Earth, you know, existed and it is basically a nuclear wasteland. And they're not sure why, but it's there. And
I have an idea.
What's your idea, Dan? Why do you think we might have some problems with radioactive planets in the
future? Basically, everyone in the earlier Foundation novels is like Yosemite Sam of Nucleics, just sort of like beep 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 beep, like firing them off. And who could have thought that Nucleics and everything might have some sort of negative
some consequences.
Consequences? Yeah, you never know.
That's what happens when you get away from, you know, vegan tobacco fuel sources and you move towards.
I'm telling you, it's like, yeah, the safety of fossil fuels is underrated.
Yeah, exactly.
The devil, you know, as opposed to the devil that's pours melting down outside in your pants because you have a nucleic belt buckle.
Right.
nucleic pillow.
Holding up my pants.
Yeah, like nucleic suspenders that you're wearing. And you're like, oh, that's a problem.
Is that a nuclear reaction in your pants? Or?
Yeah, well, it's like you could have your pants fall down or you could have your pants stay up and the nuclear fallout in your pants. One of the two.
Right.
But what I think is that this, you know, this happened, like this fallout must happen. They don't tell us when it happened, but it must have happened closer to 50,000 years ago than 500 years ago. And yet only 500 years ago, everything was all about nucleics in the dawn of the first Foundation, right, on Terminus.
Atomics
nucleics, you know. Now it's all about mentalics and what's
gravitics
and gravitics.
People have to fold their own paper. People have to sort of dispose of their own hexagons in the traditional fashion. But that's the thing.
It's like their offices.
Yeah, just lighting them on fire with various. That's like the same point we along the same lines with the tobacco. They figured out that maybe, you know, but again, not long ago, just very recently, they figured out they smoked tobacco willy-nilly for 49,500 years with no consequences. And then it's just the last 500, like, oh,
you know what happened was that the vegan tobacco ran out and they had started having to smoke the unfiltered carnivorous tobacco, and that became a bigger problem. Yes, yeah, and like the menthols.
They had to smoke the cools version of cools, and they're like, "Yeah, it's not so great after all."
I mean, they got cut off from the Newport planet, and then that became a whole separate issue.
That's probably an embargo of like with, you know, think about Cuba and the U.S. All the quality tobacco producing planet has some sort of communist takeover, and they can no longer. They're outside the Federation trade. Operation.
That's the real reason the Seychelles Union isn't
Nicaraguans. I don't want Nicaraguan tobacco.
I bet that's actually what happened to Terminus before they arrived. I think Terminus probably was inhabited 25,000 years ago, but they came, basically grew tobacco all over the planet, stripped out all the nutrients, and
it's a tale as old as time.
They couldn't grow anything when the Termininians made it there, so they had to weather control
Terminians.
No, you live in a
Terminineals.
The Terminators.
The Terminites.
The Terminatrixes. I was looking. I had to look up the other day what you call people from Morocco, and it turns out it's Moroccans.
Oh, you didn't know that?
Yeah, I thought it was something. Might be something.
You're like Moroccos,
like moccasins. Great. Turns out it's Moroccans.
Okay. Yes, it is.
Moroccans.
I guess if you're not like doing anything on a day to day basis with a particular country or a country's people, that kind of what they're called or what they go by doesn't really come up.
Especially if they're many parsecs away and an uncharted section of whatever the galaxy you're a globocentrist.
Right.
Like some people in the book are.
Like if you wanted to like figure out what people from Taiwan are called, like would you? I'm pretty sure they're not called Taiwanians.
They're called Taiwanatrices.
They're called Chinese people, according to
China.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so are people from Korea, Japan, Southeast Asia, and everywhere else around.
One of my friends is Taiwanese. my friends is Taiwanese. Mm-hmm. They're called Chinese Taipeans is probably what they're called. But she was born in Taiwan. Her passport says we're a birthplace Taiwan. Like she has trouble in China because they're like, well, it says Taiwan. And she's like, it's a government document. Like there's nothing I can do to change this. It's just what it is. And like they give her beef because it says Taiwan. She's like, I don't know what you want me to do with this, but sure, Chinese Taipei. You can file that with the Taiwanese government, see what they do to actually put it on my document. But yeah, there's some globocentrism, ethnocentrism.
Did you say that she had big trouble in Little China?
It depends on me. It's probably
where's
not
the Jack big, Burton when you need
trouble.
Him?
Somebody had the biggest trouble.
Yeah,
that you could have. Bonk. But yeah, it's interesting in that he's come to see the light, Aizimov, and the rest of the. I guess it's how much of it is a fairy tale, you know, maybe covering something darker, you know, like I mean the allusion to before to like the Black Panther, where it's like, oh, people think about Wakanda, it's a certain thing, and it's all just a front because that's where, you know, all this magical technologies, but they want everyone to think it's just a place you shouldn't go and there's nothing there. How much of it is actually the truth? And Earth, this place is sort of like a no-go because it's really a no-go, or is it just because they want people to think it's a no-go? Because it seems like in a lot of the conversations, it's like just word of mouth from historical and like, oh, whatever Kompor's like family, external history, you know, coming into the spoken word data that's not really hard from anywhere. It's just his knowledge. And everyone else is like, I don't know anything else. All of a sudden you're the expert. It's like, you can see how that could, you know, not necessarily, it's not like he went there or knew anything about being there. He just heard. Right. It's a meta-analysis of the layout of Earth, I guess.
Right. It's a folk tale, right? And, you know, our one reliable database that we had, which was like the Galactic Empire Library, it's all been deleted, right? Mm-hmm. But it just makes me think about like how in science fiction as a whole, like, you know, one of the, somewhere out there, somebody put together like a whole flow chart. Mm-hmm. And it was like talking about different elements of sci-fi literature. And one of them was like, is Earth inhabited? Yes, no. And it's like, if no, why? Nuclear radiation. But I'm curious to see, like, is at Earth actually like been annihilated? Like, is it like still covered with nuclear fallout?
And the answer is yes.
So my point was that I'm curious to see whether or not, like, you know, does Earth exist? It seems like it's going to. Was it actually obliterated by nuclear annihilation? Okay, maybe. Or is that like a tale? And if the former, then is it still uninhabitable? Or is it like healed itself, right? Because like that's like
that's the half-life of the Foundation isotopes.
Right. Like, so like in Aliens, right, one of the things is they're like, they talk about Earth. They're like, oh, Earth. What, like, I'm not going to say what they say, but they refer to it like essentially as like a trash heap, right? Like, oh, no one, you don't want to go there.
It's like WALL-E, right? It's just like a giant trash receptacle that people just like threw trash out around them. And like they started living on the piles of trash.
And then, you know, in Aliens, like at one point in, I don't know, the fourth one, they make it back to Earth. Right. And it's Earth has healed itself, mm-hmm. like with the lack of a human presence to like screw it all up essentially. Yeah. So I'm curious because of WALL-E.
WALL-E found the plant in the refrigerator that was growing in the soil, in the shoe. Remember?
I didn't see WALL-E, so I can't comment on that.
Oh, okay. You guys don't know WALL-E?
I know which one WALL-E. It is. It's the Disney movie, the Pixar movie with the Johnny Five guy driving around. But it reminds me of another point, like you mentioned about healing itself. There's like webcams that are set up in Chernobyl. And, you know, it's been whatever, 30, 40 years since that whole circumstance. And like a lot of the radiation levels are still super high. And we might have talked about this like seasons ago, but they're super high around the area, but there's been no human intervention there since everybody peaced out mm-hmm. when the meltdown happened. And wildlife has sort of re-entered into the world and sort of taken over. And so generally, like, if you're a deer, yeah, like, eventually if, like, you drink the water, some of your deer are going to get cancer and die, but some are not. And so, like, eventually over time, there's no pollution or any other kind around there. And so, like, flora and fauna and animals have re-entered the society, and that's only after 40 years. And I'm sure some of them will have fallout, bad use a word, but will have fallout because of the nuclear circumstances, but they can still survive in population numbers. And they've already sort of begun to heal as a planet within it's 40 years.
They made a documentary about that.
Pressure, yeah.
They made a documentary about Chernobyl, like the Chernobyl Diaries or Chernobyl Chronicles or something. Did you guys see that?
I didn't see. I read it. I was reading. It was meta analysis.
Yeah, some young tourists. They took a tourist trip and videoed it, and there was, like, you know, like the wildlife you're talking about, like there was like a giant eel in the water that ate one of them, and then there was like these weird mutated human people babies that like attacked the humans and chased them away and stuff. Yeah, you guys have no idea what I'm talking about. It's a B movie horror film called Chernobyl Chronicles or something like
that. I was gonna say it seems fake, but yes, at the same time, it's an interesting point. It's like, what's the half-life of cesium, whatever, 237?
But the real question here, but the real question is here is, like, does it or does it not affect the functionality of the synapsifier? Right?
I don't know.
It seems like it's affecting yours.
I'm running my synapsifier right now, Peter.
I'm pretty sure that the common trait of all Florida men is a lack of a synapsifier.
Well, maybe I'm the exception then.
I like that one.
It was removed from your person when you left Connecticut and basically turned it in with your license plate. Basically, when you cross the state border, Delaware, they confiscate it.
I just wanted to alert the authorities.
Like Connecticut borders Delaware.
Jason has identified himself as being in Florida.
He said he was from Florida.
Yes.
If not, he'll edit this entire part out.
Perfect.
That's the common theme of anyone who lives in the United States is that they don't have a lack of a synapsifier. None of the United States people has a synapsifier.
So what are you guys leaning towards as far as, like, the Earth scenario? Like, you guys have an opinion?
I haven't thought about it.
My opinion is it's classic Asimov. He's setting us up with a scenario that could go either way. Earth could be a magical Garden of Eden where the anti-mules are controlling the second foundation and the rest of the galaxy better than the second foundationers ever imagined they could. Or it's a nuclear wasteland and they've relocated to some other planet, but before they relocated, they established some kind of secret society and are, you know, are working in this behind the scenes. But I think the Earth as the source of this kind of alternate power in the universe is definitely
a possibility.
It's got to be the channel of this other power, like with the state of Earth in its current day and age. Mm-hmm. Anybody's guess.
A Chekhov's. That's my take on it. It's a Chekhov's gun.
Mm.
It can't be this sort of integral plot point, and then they show up, and it's like, oh, turns out there was nothing there all along. You know, it just seems like there has to be something there.
Right.
In a way that narratively it seems way too big of a red herring to just be a red herring.
Jason,
what that means, I don't know. I just know that it can't be like, it turns out he was right the whole time. Oh, okay, maybe let's go somewhere else.
Maybe the synapsifier is a planet-wide machine that radiates out into the universe, and so nobody goes near it because they get this radiation reading. But it's actually the synapsifier is blasting these control beams out to the universe and controlling the minds that it needs to.
That's a plot line for the next book, Foundation Psych. It just goes to the Earth and they're like, yeah, sorry, nothing there.
Yeah.
Fooled ya.
Made you blink.
The swerve of Asimov is that there's nothing there to be swerved about. Sorry.
Two for flinching.
Two for flinching, Asimov. Made you look, as my children say. Made you look.
Peter's so got
Jason,
something.
You mentioned something about, like, you know, you said mule. You said the word mule. Mm-hmm. And that made me think about, you know, the OG mule, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And the idea that he just kind of, like, showed up, right? And I think I like the idea if let's say the Earth is filled with, like, you know, this this anti-mule society that's trying to, like, keep the foundation and the second foundation, like, on the golden path or whatever. The idea that maybe, like, the original mule was, like, a part of this third foundation and was, like, an abandoned child or something like that, that somehow got mislocated to the wrong world, and therefore they, you know, that kind of hole that was inside of him, like, still steered him towards unifying the galaxy, just kind of, like, under his thumb, as opposed to, like, you know, trying to better humanity for whatever reason.
There's, it seems like there's a lot of blowback to the second foundation actions, that, you know, there's always unintended consequences to what they're doing, and they're not obviously operating above the level. It wouldn't surprise me in the least bit to have, you know, a couple of,
You get, like, you know, got some
whoopsies.
Yeah, like Corona leaves the lab, or Lyme, you know, escapes from Lyme, Connecticut, you know, CDC facility.
Right. Yeah.
The Ebola monkeys.
Right.
Somehow make their way from Africa to rest of Virginia.
It's the 12 monkeys circumstances with the second foundation.
Yeah. Just, and
like, Emil is the Brad Pitt character.
But just the statistics of, like, I think they touched on it in, was it the Foundation and Empire, right? In Burr. And he's going on about the, Han, Fran Solo and his white haired uncle or something like that.
Lando Calrissian.
Yeah, Lando.
Rando. One arm Rando.
Yeah. And they're going on about the probabilities of other mutants or something. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it was different characters. I can't remember at this point, but they were going on and
different characters, different planet, different book.
Yeah. And they were talking about the probabilities of hundreds or thousands of mules out there, you know, but, like, the circumstances not lining up right. And again, in this book, they talk about the quadrillions of people that the Second Foundation should be recruiting from, but they just can't, you know, reach all of those people and recruit Second Foundationers when they should. That's how Trevise slipped through the cracks and became this kind of independent, strong mind outside of the control of the Second Foundation, or outside of the training of the Second Foundation, at least.
There's also the possibility that they're, like, you know, maybe it's not really, like, a third foundation that's, like, mind controlling the Second Foundation. It could be, like, a similar to a Second Foundation running in parallel, right? Like, you know, they can see the deviations in, like, you know, what would be prosperity and harmony and whatnot. Like, the idea that, you know, like, our guy, who was the founder?
Harry Seldon.
Yeah, Harry Seldon, right? The idea that Harry Seldon, like, came up with this whole psychohistory thing all on his own, and he was the only one who could do it. Like, when you're dealing with a quadrillion people, right? And maybe he is the one in quadrillion, right? But there's also, like, a pretty good possibility that there might be, like, a two in quadrillion type of person, right? So the idea that, like, maybe these two foundations are running in parallel, that's kind of an interesting idea that I hadn't really considered until now.
I bet it's not, if you're talking about, like, real statistics with that many people, what, you know, if you go back and you look at, like, just in the past 100 or so years, like, harnessing electricity, the invention of the automobile, like, we want to give credit to, like, one or two people because it's easier to remember. But the fact of the matter is that there was, like, dozens, if not hundreds of people doing the same stuff all over the place at the same time. And, you know, they get lost to history because somebody kind of rises to the top and just, you know, has the right circumstances for their solution to succeed. But society in general is kind of, like, evolving together across society, setting up certain individuals to kind of stumble upon the same discovery at about the same time. And the patent office deals with this all the time, right? They have multiple people in multiple places in the country that are completely disconnected, submitting patents for similar ideas at about the same time. And they have to go through this whole, you know, process to figure out who did it first. And, well, you know, anyway, if that we're talking about quadrillions of people, like it's not one or two foundations. There's got to be hundreds of foundations out there, like people with mind right. powers all over the place, mutants like the mule. They got to be, you know, even if they're on one in 10 planets, like the, right. we're talking about hundreds of planets, you know, there's dozens right. Of mules and people who discover like, their powers right without training.
Right. And I think that's an excellent point. And also you can probably eliminate a good number of those too, because of like the lack of relevance that they have, right? Like they may or may not be back in part of like the larger foundation. Right. And they may have like extinguished themselves because they were bad at it, or they just weren't in the right environment. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of possibilities, yeah. but probably for like the simplicity of the story, right? Mm-hmm. There's probably like the, one other, or it's probably like a shadow organization that we don't really know what's going on with.
Mm-hmm. Like the Linguisters, I found the name. Those are the three generations of.
You watch your mouth. That's a linguistical nightmare right there that you threw out there.
But I didn't mispronounce it. We talked about it before with regards to like historical people and the same thing. Like we're talking about Columbus, where it's like Columbus is this famous guy, but ultimately anybody, there was tons of people just traveling around on the King's Dime looking for locations and sailing about. One of those guys would have found it. It's not like Columbus is this Ubermensch even. He's just a guy. Just sometimes like in the Big Lebowski, sometimes there's a guy, right. He's just a guy. And it's, for his particular time and place. That's just, he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. He's sailing a guy, to a place, dude. Not even knowing that he was in the right place. And, you know, he looked back and like kind of got lost, ended up at a place where he thought he was, where he wasn't. And right. nothing really came of it, but he's super famous 500 years later.
And nobody remembers Amerigo Vespucci.
I'm just saying, Amerigo Vespucci. Oh, isn't the country's named after him, which, you know, I guess is something.
Yeah. Yeah, but nobody celebrates Amerigo Day. Yet
Vasco da Gama, nothing. Not a single thing.
Right.
It's maybe in Portugal it was big. But
right. And he didn't commit genocide as far as we know.
Yeah, well, you went around the Horn of Africa, and then what happened? The dark side of the deepest, darkest port of Africa. You never know. I guarantee there's some shady things going on because it was 1512 or whatever. That's just kind of the way things went. Back in those days, they might have even the 1400s, but that's
don't worry. Nautical podcast. As a society, we'll forget about that soon enough. If my last week is any indication of the of the hope of history and the future of humanity, I've had an encounter where somebody said instead of Ponce de Leon, they were like Ponce de Leon or something like that. And then
Ponce de Leon.
Yeah, Ponce de Leon.
It's Florida's own.
Yeah. Ponce and then, Leon. And then just,
go to Florida, man.
Just Ponce today, a whole group of people, one person mentioned a barbershop quartet and like some young kid who was there, probably 19, maybe 20, says, "What's a barbershop quartet?" And I thought, oh, well, that's, I guess, you know, a little bit before his time. And then the middle-aged 40-something-year-old woman who also happened to be in part of that conversation was like, yeah, let's look it up. Let's Google it. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Like, people don't know what a barbershop quartet is?
The good thing, well, that's a little bit, you know, sort right? of unique because of your musical background. But the good news of that, the bright side of that is that it's very easy to find the information. So if you wanted to know it, it's not like you have to like go scour, buy an encyclopedia.
Right.
But like, yeah, I mean, it's like the saying goes, it's like, think of the stupidest person you know, and then realize that half of the country is probably stupider than that person. You know, it's just like,
do you think that if people stop searching for stuff like Google is just like, I got these things that people are searching for, like, you know, I got like 100 hits a minute. And then I got these things that I get like somebody searches for it once every 3 years. Like, I'm just going to like save some server space and not catalog that stuff anymore because nobody really looks for it. Like, do you think that's happening?
Are you talking about the Such Nerds podcast?
Their business is knowing everything about everyone. And so they, if they aren't collecting data about obscure things, that's what their business is knowing what these obscure people and serving them up to various people and slicing and dicing them.
Things now on Google.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
But nobody's weird on the internet, Jason.
I know.
No.
There's hope there for you.
Yeah.
No. Everyone's super weird, and it's come full circle. Everybody realizes exactly how weird everyone is, which is a positive, but
I think it's an improvement, honestly. You should be ashamed of certain things.
Well, there's certain things that are just like, that's the dark cloud of it. If everyone was normal, nobody's normal, number one. But number two, like, being normal is kind of boring. You don't want to hang out with normal people. It's just not very interesting way to spend your life. And there's downsides to quote unquote normalcy. Mm-hmm. But like, the flip side of it is that, like, well, yes, that's true. But like, there's also a downside to like extreme eccentricity, you know? I mean, it's interesting. The whole business, you know, it's kind of like usual, set up for the interesting next phase about who's going to go. Now you've got, you know, Jindabal and Nobi tearing across the galaxy to meet up with Kompor to sort of do. And then they made the point at the end of their conversation, you know, after Kompor's like, oh, Linda, what are you going to do? I'll come get you. And he's like, no, you can't come get me. You're going to relay our ship, you moron. And he's basically, oh, well, that's a good point. Yeah.
What are you, some kind of lower tier second foundationer?
Gave the dude, who's like the secretary at the office, gives him the old like boink in the brain while his screen is going down. And he just, like, I'm in the ear or whatever the mentality thing is. But then he's like, well, what are we going to do now? And Jindabal's like, well, I'm going to take over. It's like, bum, bum, bum.
He's, you know, he's got this very simple Amish woman on the ship with him. He's like, he keeps realizing that he likes having her there. He likes her attention, the attention she gives him, the respect she shows
her, admiration.
Every time he, you know, feels like he's comforting her, he realizes that she's actually comforting him. He's just rationalizing with himself that this is okay. Like, it's not a big deal. It's different
foundation. He's getting foundationed.
It feels
Hamish person.
I think the way he says it, it's like, it feels like Beta when she casts her spell on the mule because of her sincere admiration for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or at least like,
and then it's his undoing. Humanity, he's right? Like, but this is different. This is totally different.
It's totally different. Totally different this time.
So besides Trevise now getting amplified as this kind of special mind that is beyond Kompor's, you know, Kompor rehension, and this love
straight
affair.
That's a tough one.
That was a reach. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond Kompor's reach, if you will.
Okay, but
and then he's got, you know, the Gendabal's got his fair lady with him. You know, she and Trevise, my suspicion of them as being agents of another force have been amplified by going through this chapter. And I feel like it's very Isimovian to focus on, to say agent and talk about Kompor very overtly as the agent, but really in the end, we're going to look back and be like, oh, he really meant so-and-so was an agent, and he had this like cover story of the actual overt agent, but there was this subtle agent.
Yeah.
Peter might even call it subterfuge, although I don't think that's the appropriate word. You might use it anyway.
I hadn't looked at it like that, but now I can't unsee that.
Yeah, you get that Isimov paranoia. Well, maybe that guy.
Yeah, now I'm like looking over my shoulder like, but that's exactly what he wants me to think.
That's exactly what Isimov wants me to think. I mean, Trevise gave him a sardonic, which I thought was, you know, in his back and forth.
Was there?
I missed the sardonic. I glossed over it in the summary. You know, he was coming in hot with Kompor, which I guess I could sort of understand because he sort of like got him exiled from the planet by, you know, he mentioned something to him somewhat confidence, and Kompor basically just, but you think about it as second foundationer back then, makes a little bit of sense. But Trevise said sardonically when he was, you know, Kompor's like, oh, you know, I was doing this just to try to get some action done, and, you know, and wanted to make sure that your theory was spread widely. And he says sardonically, endanger the foundation, but keep ourselves safe. That's good patriotic stuff. And it was like, then he starts arguing back and his forehead gets damp. But yeah, his whole affect, that whole argument is like a very sardonic, like, oh sure, yeah, I'm mocking you because I don't believe you, while at the same time I'm sort of like looking down upon you for, you know, selling me out.
When he's when he's talking to Compor,
yeah,
that son of two strangers,
yeah, that son of two strangers, yeah, on a super comfortable butt forming chair. And there were some interesting technological, you know, there's some, yes, technological robot bus boys, yes, there.
I actually had one of those at a sushi restaurant that I went to recently. There was a bus boy sushi tray delivery, and I guess they could have used it to take back the trays, but they just used it to deliver the trays of food.
Was it nucleically powered?
Very Japanese. Was it nucleically powered? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess they're super popular in Japan right now, these little like delivery robots, so that they can navigate to the table. Yeah.
They don't have any young people to actually work in the economy.
Dan, they have a new idea in here that I think, you know, it's like, I think we're almost ready for it as a society, and I think Asimov is going to get full credit in my mind for inventing this. At one point when they have to pay for their meal, Trevise groped beneath his sash.
Yes, I mean, he groped beneath the sash.
And then he pulled out a credit card, which was, I guess, recognized galaxy-wide. So they must have a hyper-relay payment clearinghouse, yeah, that receives all of the credit card transaction data and processes it so that his foundation credits can be, you know, recognized. It was just amazing.
They just sell off the receivables somewhere else. Yeah. They issue commercial paper, right, just sell it off to some black hole in the galaxy. And just be like, oh, sure, we'll just sell, yeah, these liabilities down the line. Some fool, some retirement account on, right, you know, Sirius sector exactly, will be investing in these terrible, you know, these foundation dudes show up on Seychelles to buy this meal. They're going to be like, galaxies, hyperspace jumps gone. And they'd be like, come and collect on this $74 tab on your Foundation Express card. And he's like, sorry, I'm like 9 zillion light years away. Like, come and get me for $73. Like, it's just the whole, and talk about the economic underpinning.
Yes.
Probably some time to go into some super details, but it's like, how does that, and they're already on a planet that's not really in the Foundation. They're probably like, I don't have to pay this bill.
Yeah. Yeah. Diners Club in Tibet or something, you know, like,
yeah, just like, how credit, well, the foundation always pays its debts. It's just, I ain't, yeah, paying this one. Come get me on.
But then he won't get the points, Dan.
Yeah, clearly.
You know, clearly. I think restaurant, like, probably 3%, you know, like three points per.
He's angling for those credits back. Yeah, 2X and Exo Foundation planets.
God knows he's getting miles. He's getting enough miles.
Essentially, you know, like, flyer miles. Frequent hyperspace flyer miles. Yeah, that was another great one. I had that one highlighted. It's a credit card, which with its foundation imprint was good anywhere in the galaxy or anywhere a foundation citizen was likely to go. Such as the Seychelles sector, I guess. When you read about it, it's a debit card.
It's a debit card because it's loaded with foundation credits. Yeah.
On this card, right, and this meal plan. Right. So my whole analogy is totally useless and can be cut out. So fantastic. But yes, with native caution, checks on the remaining balance before returning it to his pocket, just to know.
Yep. So it holds foundation credits. Yes. And that's why it's called a credit card, not because it is, yeah, actually an
actual credit card,
debt loaded
credit line.
It doesn't have a lot of credit. He just carries a dozen eggs around.
Which in
the
1982 sounds about right, right? Was it 1982? Yeah, right. How did it work in 1982? Credit cards. It was basically
you need to have your father sign for you, yeah, if you're a woman.
There was only certain banks that really even issued credit cards.
And you had to have like an account balance, sufficient account balance. And then it was like, it was just basically a monthly billing process, right? You just like put it on the card so you could just pay the monthly bill.
It was issued by bank holding corporations, right, because they had assets secured against, right, you. It was very much not like it is now, like where you're just selling off these receivables to some Tom, Dick, and Harry, mm-hmm, you know.
Yep.
We have Asimov to blame for the massive amounts of credit card debt that are in. And then obviously the physical hyperwave communicator, which was pretty interesting. Right. you know, like outer space, space time, or whatever it is. That was another good one. And yeah, a lot of technological know-how.
Honest to galaxy, Dan, I think we skipped over a very important matter. We didn't talk about the competitive technologies, right? The hyperwave communicator, which is like a crystal clear image, and then you have the mentalist, or what is it?
Secure line
of brain to brain communication.
The sat bone between second foundationers.
But you have to pay attention to every detail because not all of the clarity is there as if it was a hyper relay communication. You have to catch everything.
Did you see that? It's like not all like the unspoken second foundation winks and nods and twitches come through because they're not all words. Or is it just that like, because you said like the bit rate is not enough to get all the bits. It's like,
right. Well, it's a lot of pixelated winks,
whatever sort of fifth dimensional communication, you know, like, ridiculous winks.
Right.
Surreptitious wink.
Right.
So. What about junior varsity, like relay?
Yeah, I was going to say, the only other one was just about his fantastic hyper.
That was so weird.
A hyper relay in junior high or whatever.
Hyperspatial, whatever.
We get the concept.
Yeah.
You know, I get the concept. Here it is. Yes. He said, isn't it strange that he followed us all the way to Seychelles? He said he had this intuitive ability. Yes, he was all collegiate champion at hyper-tracking. I never questioned that till today. I quite see that you might be able to judge where someone was going to jump on how he prepared for it if he had a certain developed skill at it, certain reflexes, but I don't see how a tracker can judge a jump series. You prepare only for the first one. The computer does all the others. The tracker can judge that first one. By what magic can he guess what's in the computer's vitals? The only possible way I can imagine him doing so is by knowing in advance where we were going to go, by knowing, not judging. So that might be the truth. Who knows? Maybe he isn't just a great tracker. But it's possible he's got the same ship, so their computers might very well be like
communicating together,
right? Tuned to the same frequency, right?
Right.
I don't know. We'll find out next time.
All right. Peter.
Yes. I think, Peter, before you fall completely asleep,
do you think you can mumble a few closing words
for us here? I definitely can.
You said, that's all, folks.
All right. Well, gentlemen, before we close out tonight, do you guys have anything else you want to say? Anything else? Any last thoughts?
I personally think that Asimov's woven quite an interesting web, and there was a bit of reveal this week, which is nice, but it doesn't really clear anything up.
I think that Trevise is going to like second guess his desire to stay and decide to leave. He's going to actually do what Compor tried to recommend him to do with this reverse psychology maneuver as a double reverse psychology.
I'm a Gemini. Expect the unexpected.
All right. Well, I think we've sufficiently beaten this horse to death. So next week,
Horse-like creature.
We'll be reading a to-be-determined amount of foundation, and then we'll talk about it. Kind of depends on how much we actually get.
How long these chapters are.
These are long chapters.
And how long they feel. It's really like a feel kind of sense. There's a guaranteed 13, a possible 14 in our future. So I hope you guys will join us all next week. I've been your host for tonight, Peter, along with
Dan from Los Angeles
and Jason from Florida.
And we'll see you guys next week. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. and then like poured coffee, almost poured coffee all over my desk.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. Pour the coffee into the computer. It doesn't go faster.